miracle stories. This is Roman numeral 4a. And I was going to give you an introductory example. Yeah. Luke 8, 26 to 39. I'm not sure I will. We're likely to run out of time, I'm afraid. So let me skip that. B, general principles in approaching miracle stories. I am going to follow, in an overly mechanical way, what I've done with parables, just to, again, stimulate us. I do think there are some parallels, but I do think we have to be careful as well, because the parallels are not, don't always go on all fours. They don't always correspond perfectly. Miracle stories are their own thing and not simply acted out parables, as I think we'll see. But having said that qualification, let's see what we can do. So point one is the challenge of miracle stories. This is under the general principles. And just as we might ask about parables, both the why and the what, so we might ask about miracles. Why are there miracles? Well, many people, I think this is the less of a problem. Parables, why did Jesus do that when our unsanctified instincts are just blurt everything out? With miracles, we may feel that we understand why, namely, that the miracles are an authentication of the Messiah and a demonstration of divine power. And they are. I think that is part of the answer. But even so, there are why questions that remain in terms of some of the details. If the purpose is the authentication of the Messiah and a demonstration of divine power, why, for instance, did Jesus refuse to work miracles at some times? And why did he take somewhat odd routes in doing so at other times? For instance, touching the leper. Have we talked about that? When he heals the leper in Luke 5, he touches him, which is a social faux pas from the standpoint of ordinary Israelite. That is a shocking element. Or he forbids the leper, that same man, but also in some other cases, forbids people to tell and spread the news. Now, you know, if you're going to do things that are an authentication of the Messiah and demonstration of divine power, well, you know, in other words, there's still some puzzling things if you think this is just straightforward. And then the paralytic comes to him to be healed, and he says, your sins are forgiven. And you can go through these things. There are quite a few things that are not quite as straightforward as people might like them to be. B is the what of miracles. In what way are they significant beyond the mere display of power? In other words, if you're just going to display power, then do it once and get it over with. Why? Well, okay, so you multiply miracles so that more people can see them, but is there any significance, you see, to the particularities of miracles? And I think there is. So again, this is point two then. We may face, in analogy with parables, the possibility of two interpretive extremes. Now, this has not been, you know, in modern times, I think a lot of discussion about miracle stories in scholarly circles has been whether they really occurred. Because, you know, the anti-supernatural hang-ups. And I already told you I'm not going to discuss that. I think they did. Right? And I want us to get on with the thing, right? Although, apologetically, obviously, you still have to deal with that. But because of that, this has not been such a problem because the scholarly forces have focused in other directions. But potentially, the same problem is still there. Namely, the extremes of extreme elaboration of interpretation and the extreme of simplification. The extreme of simplification being that there is only one point per miracle and that easily discernible. For instance, and here I probably should have gone through this example because I'm going to use it some. Let's at least read the passage so that we know about it. It's in Luke 8. It's the demoniac, the Gadarene demoniac, Luke 8:26. They sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is off across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man. Many a time it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged him repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into them, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. Well, that even is not the end of the story, because there's a reaction of the townspeople, verses 34 to 39, taking up considerable space. But even if you just cut the story off there, there are already some interesting things about this thing. You expect, well, Jesus, just get on with it, cast out the demons. There's all this discussion, and the demons don't come out right of the way. He commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man, and the evil spirit doesn't, you know, doesn't do it, at least not right away. So there's peculiarities of that kind, but what I want to draw your attention to is, for this story, if you use the end of extreme simplification, that is, Jesus has power to save this man from the devil. Or the healing of the leper, Jesus has power to heal. The healing of the paralytic, Jesus has power to heal. You're right, you start getting, pretty soon, it's the same lesson, right, time after time. The other extreme of elaboration, the demoniac's lack of clothes corresponds to mankind's loss of the garment of righteousness. His dwelling not in a house is the lack of heavenly dwelling. His dwelling among the tombs is spiritual death. His breaking bonds of other men is enmity with mankind. Well, I mean, you can go on. I wrote that up myself. You can do it if you want to do it. You can imagine, you know, something that thoroughly allegorizes this story, basically, and it's the picture of being rescued from spiritual death. All right, so we're confronted then with somewhat similar issues to what we have with parables when we start thinking beyond of, okay, this is a demonstration of divine power. Third point, what is a miracle story? The size and scope of the genre, as with parables. Remember what we did there and said some things were labeled parable, but that they were similar to other things that were not necessarily labeled a parable, that were pretty obviously were parables. And then you begin to stand out and you realize that the genre doesn't have sharp boundaries, but you have not only full-blown stories, long stories, but you have shorter ones and shorter ones, and then you have ones that are just sort of, you know, a metaphor that is hardly developed at all. Similarly, in miracle stories, we're in a sense in a worse position because the terminology even is not so fixed. There are several words, teros, wonder, dunamis, and a plural, these are typically in plural, miracles or acts of power, semeia and John, but then again you see you're using terminology the different gospel writers are different. But there's not a lot of use of that terminology, actually, until you get to Acts. With Acts, there are summary statements that have that terminology. Here, it's mostly just description. This is what Jesus did without the actual technical terminology. What about, what is the miracle story, then, in terms of genre? There are, full-blown miracle stories, that is, pericope-length stories or episode-long stories, separate episodes in the gospel whose main focus is on some problem, often with a particular individual who is tormented by demons or who is sick or ill or physically has problems in one way or another. And then that Jesus responds to that. There's also, of course, the stilling of a storm. There are nature miracles too. But basically what we're talking about is there are some things whose focus is clearly on the story of Jesus' miraculous works in response to some problem in the situation. But then, B, there are also what you might call one-line miracles. Luke 22:51. But Jesus answered, "No more of this," and he touched the man's ear and healed him. Well, that's really not a whole episode. It's part of an episode, right? And the focus of the episode is on Jesus' arrest and not really on the miracle. And then, C, there are what I call demi-miracles. Again, that's my term. Where Jesus shows extraordinary insight, but where one may sometimes not know whether is this a miraculous insight or is it just a very keen, wise human insight? Or both, right? Because we're dealing, of course, with Jesus who's both God and man. And but what I'm dealing with, in effect, are phenomena where the text really describes what happens without thoroughly analyzing it for us, and we're left with a feeling, well, something remarkable happened, but what do we say that thing was? Luke 7:40, the incident with the sinful woman in the house of Simon the Pharisee. The Pharisee, this is back in 39, the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, that is the woman and how she was kissing Jesus' feet and caring for him. He said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would have known who is touching him, what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two men owned money to a certain moneylender," and so on. Well, you probably remember the story. Jesus, and it's ironic, right? Because Jesus not only knows that this woman is a sinner, but he knows what Simon is thinking. namely, that Jesus is really not a prophet because he doesn't realize this woman is a sinner. And then the irony being, of course, Jesus demonstrates that he's a prophet. But the reasoning that Jesus gives to Simon almost has the effect of saying, "Can't you see, Simon, that anybody can see that this woman is a sinner? Or she wouldn't be responding with his lavish love." So it's almost that he himself, what would be a miracle of insight, right, both into the woman and into Simon, Jesus takes away some of the miraculous character of it by his explanation. It becomes something between a miracle and a wise observation of somebody who knows human nature so well that he can understand where the woman's coming from without her saying anything. So is this a miracle or isn't it, right? And I mean, on some level, it doesn't matter, right? Of how, I mean, Jesus is God and man, to ask how did he come into these things is sort of an unanswerable question, right? Because there's a deep mystery in it. But you could understand how, to a degree, some of it would be at least plausibly explainable by saying, well, you know, he had insight into human nature. Luke 9:47. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. Similar kind of problem in a way. Because, you know, you could say, okay, this is miraculous insight, or you could say, Jesus had been with these guys long enough to know what they were like. Luke 22:31. "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat." How does he know that? Right? And he's just going to predict in verse 34 that Peter will deny him three times, which seems to be a miraculous insight. Luke 22:10-12. "As you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters and say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher, ask, where's the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' He will show you a large upper room all furnished. Make preparations there. Is that a miracle, or is it something Jesus had arranged beforehand? Who knows? Luke 4:30. Oh yeah, this is a nice one. Luke 4:30 is the synagogue at Nazareth where they reject him and they lead him out to the brow of the hill to kill him. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. How did he do that? and again, it's one of these things. It's not a whole episode. It's something that just leaves you wondering, is this a miracle? Maybe it is. Okay. So the point then is, I think there is a point. Namely, that the full-blown miracles towards which we typically address our attention, though they are very special and deserve our attention, they are perhaps not so utterly isolated from the whole of who Jesus is and what he's doing all the time.